Well, good morning, everybody. Go ahead and turn in your Bibles to Acts chapter 22. We're going to be continuing to look at Paul's arrest in Jerusalem and some of the events that surround that. I'm sorry, did I say 22? We tried to get to 22 last week, but we didn't. So we're actually in 21. All right. So Acts chapter 21, I'm not going to reread this whole section, but we're going to work on section 27 through the end of the chapter again here. We just kind of had gotten to that portion. In the lead up to that discussion, we are talking about the vow that the elders in Jerusalem had recommended that Paul take part in, most likely it being a Nazarite vow. And of course, the intention of that was to help people understand that the false things that they'd been taught about what Paul was teaching, that they weren't true. And of course, we'll cover a little bit of that when we get to some of the things that Paul does in defense of his actions. But let's go ahead and pick it up here. We'll start in verse 27. Let's read down through verse 36. It says, when the 7 days were almost over, the Jews from Asia, upon seeing him in the temple, began to stir up all the crowd and laid hands on him, crying out, "Men of Israel, come to our aid. This is the man who preaches to all men everywhere against our people and the law in this place, and besides, he's even brought Greeks into the temple and has defiled this holy place." For they had previously seen Trophimus, the Ephesian, in the city with him, and they supposed that Paul had brought him into the temple. Then all the city was provoked, and the people rushed together, and taking hold of Paul, they dragged him out of the temple, and immediately the doors were shut. While they were seeking to kill him, a report came up to the commander of the Roman cohort that all Jerusalem was in confusion. At once he took along some soldiers and centurions and ran down to them, and when they saw the commander and the soldiers, they stopped beating Paul. Then the commander came up and took hold of him and ordered him to be bound with two chains, and he began asking who he was and what he had done. But among the crowd, some were shouting one thing and some another, and when he could not find out the facts because of the uproar, he ordered him to be brought into the barracks. When he got to the stairs, he was carried by the soldiers because of the violence of the mob, for the multitude of the people kept following them, shouting, "Away with him." So Paul, he's doing his best. He goes into Jerusalem, counsels with the elders, and they say, okay, here's what we're going to do to try to offset some of this anger that has developed against you. So he decides, yep, he agrees, let's go ahead and do this. And then he goes in and encounter something that he's pretty much used to. And that is that there are some Jews from Asia that come in and they stir up the mob to seize Paul. Does sound familiar? Kind of the same repetitive process that we've seen in his missionary journeys pretty much everywhere he goes. He is generally attacked by a mob that is drummed up by the religious leaders of the Jews in the area. And of course, they stir up this mob and they seize Paul. And they're accusing him of the same things that the brethren had heard. So if you go back to verse 21 there, this is the things that James and the elders are discussing with Paul. He said, "They have been told about you that you are teaching all the Jews who are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses, telling them not to circumcise their children, nor to walk according to the customs." But then they tag on an extra one, which is especially egregious, and that is, of course, that he brought a Gentile into the temple. So these accusations, in a lot of ways, are not that uncommon, and they've been used successfully by other Jews in other areas to stir up the crowds. I mean, think back to Acts chapter 13 and Acts chapter 14 and 16 and 17 and You think back to the things that Paul had encountered before, and these accusations were always pretty successful in one way, shape, or form. And at this particular point where Paul's in Jerusalem, it's essentially a powder keg. He knows that they're not going to be real excited about him. He's been told this. He understands that bonds await him in Jerusalem. These Jews from Asia were probably the same ones responsible for the plots against him when Paul gives his farewell address to the Ephesian elders. So remember, where's Ephesus? What portion of the world, of the ancient world, is Ephesus in? Starts with an A, ends with an A, has an S and an I in the middle. It's Asia, okay? So let's go back to Acts chapter 20. Just want to connect some dots here. In Acts chapter 20, when Paul is giving his farewell address to the Ephesian elders, let's start here in about halfway through verse 18 where it starts out, "You yourselves." He says, "You yourselves know from the first day that I set foot in Asia how I was with you the whole time, serving the Lord with all humility and with tears and with trials which came upon me through the plots of the Jews." Now, what was the requirement for Jews regarding the day of Pentecost and the feasts that surrounded it? That, you know, it was one of those things, they should really try to make it if you can, but you know what, if you just can't make it this year, it's okay. No. You were commanded to be there, and if you didn't make it, unless there was a really good reason, and I know Leviticus discusses some of that, you were no longer considered a part of the Jewish nation. It's a big deal. So it's safe to assume that these Jews from Asia are probably, if not the same ones, certainly in contact with the ones who had made the plot, had been responsible for the plots that Paul discusses there with the Ephesian elders. And of course, as I mentioned, they add on this additional charge of bringing a Gentile into the temple, which of course was a false presumption. They just happened to see Paul with Gentiles. As we've talked about several times, Paul was traveling with Gentiles. And you take somebody to a new city, you're going to walk them around, especially when it's a big deal like this. I mean, Jerusalem, is, I'm sure at the time, was pretty remarkable. And seeing the temple was something that I'm sure people would do. So they take this opportunity because they see Trophimus. They know he's a Gentile. He, of course, was one of the ones who had accompanied him from Ephesus. And that provided the perfect opportunity for the Jews from Asia to falsely accuse him. So these same Jews are the ones who dragged Paul out of the temple. So if we go back to Acts chapter 21, you see in verse 27, it says, "Began to stir up all the crowds and laid hands on him, crying out, 'Men of Israel, come to our aid.'" These Jews from Asia understood very well how to stir up a crowd. And so they took the opportunity, like, "Hey, we found the culprit. Here he is. Come to our aid, because he is speaking against the temple and Moses and all the things that we hold dear. And even worse, he brought in this Gentile into the temple, and he has defiled it." So these people know how to stir up a crowd. And of course, this is exactly as James had predicted. Everyone now knew for certain that Paul was in town and in their midst. Remember, Paul had told them, "They will certainly figure out that you are here." James told Paul that. So, of course, we know that verse 30 there, "Then the city was provoked, and the people rushed together, and taking hold of Paul, they dragged him out of the temple, and immediately the doors were shut." So, they take hold of Paul, they drag him out amongst much confusion, and basically to keep it from getting worse, they close the doors behind him and they pretty much wipe their hands of it. And then they let the mob essentially take over. In verse 31 here, it says, "While they were seeking to kill him, a report came up to the commander of the Roman cohort that all Jerusalem was in confusion." Now, this is interesting. You put yourself back in this situation. If you remember the prophecy from Daniel, of the four world kingdoms that would arise, and then, of course, the last one that would come. What was the description of the statue right before the stone cut out of the mountain without hands? How was it described, that very last one at the bottom of the statue? Anybody remember? Right, iron and clay mixed together. What was that supposed to show? Pardon me? Okay, fractured or split. Ultimately, it was to show that that the integration that was forced integration, the different systems between the Roman systems and the Jewish systems, really you can say Roman and all the other religious systems, it didn't work. They weren't melding together. They were very separate from one another. And I often use the example, and I don't want to get into the political aspect of it, but I often use the example of the Indian reservations. They have their own law systems and their own taxation systems and their own governance, and it doesn't work very well. It hasn't. Since the beginning, it hasn't worked very well. But in this particular case, this is a big day, right? So with the feast going on in Jerusalem, there would have been millions of Jews in the city. And in the past, let's say about, roughly 60 years previous, there had been at least one particular instance where one of those Jewish guys had caused an uproar. At least once. And it happened several times. I mean, if you read through any of the annals of history of one of them specifically of Josephus, he mentioned several times where there were always these uprisings in Jerusalem during the feast because, of course, you have Jewish pride on display in a city that is controlled by the Romans. So the situation here in Rome, in Jerusalem, would not have been one of great peace. There would have been tensions very, very elevated in the area. And so as good governors, you think the Romans would have had more or less soldiers there? This is one of those, think through it. Obviously, they would have had more soldiers in the area because the need for security, in their particular perspective, would have been increased because of the number of Jews increasing in the area. So undoubtedly, this commander, whom we'll talk about here in just a second, this commander probably had ears out amongst the crowd and had soldiers watching for issues, for mob mentalities that might arise. Because in the Roman mindset, it didn't matter what the mob was about. It was against them. It was against their rule. It was against their authority. It was against their power. So they wanted to keep an eye out for things like this. So this commander, if we jump over to Acts chapter 23, I don't want to cover all that right now. Let's jump over to Acts chapter 23, verse 20. Well, start in 23. So Acts 23:23. This is the letter that the commander sends. He says that he called to him two of the centurions and said, "Get 200 soldiers ready by the third hour of the night and proceed to Caesarea with 70 horsemen and 200 spearmen. They're also to provide mounts to Paul, to put Paul on and bring him safely to Felix the governor." And he, this is the commander, he wrote a letter having this form: "Claudius Lysias to the most excellent governor Felix, greetings. When this man was arrested by the Jews and was about to be slain by them, I came up to them with the troops and rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman." We'll just stop there for the sake of time. But this commander that we see here mentioned in Acts chapter 21 is actually Claudius. And the news of this murderous mob came to Claudius as they were seeking to kill Paul. And so what happens is he rallies his troops. Now, you do a little bit of research on this. He didn't just take a couple of guys with him to shut down this mob of unruly Jews who, again, had a problem with somebody of their own nationality. He brings at least two centurions and about 200 soldiers with him. And they, of course, are then sent out to investigate. The crowds during this particular time frame, during the feast days, were immense. And, of course, it required many troops to keep the relatively uneasy peace. And if you were stationed in Jerusalem, again, a little bit of a historical perspective, as a soldier or as a governor, it was not a place you wanted to be, unless you wanted to get into trouble, unless you wanted to put down rebellions, unless you wanted to put down insurrection. So at any rate, Claudius hears about this. He sends out, he goes with a couple of centurions and a couple hundred soldiers. And of course, at this point, the crowd stops beating Paul because here comes the Roman soldiers, 200 of them, to try to find out what's going on. Now, it's interesting because let's go back here to Acts chapter 21, verse 32. And at once he took along some soldiers and centurions and ran down to them. And when they saw the commander and the soldiers, they stopped beating Paul. Then the commander came up and took hold of him and ordered him to be bound with two chains. And he began asking who he was and what he had done. So there's that presumption of guilt. Okay, they weren't assuming that Paul hadn't done anything wrong. And you'd think that think about it in today's society, hopefully. you have somebody being beaten by a mob. Hopefully, the approach would be to protect the person being beaten, not to put him in handcuffs right away. Now, whether or not that happens is another discussion that we're not going to get into. But what's that? never mind. But, of course, instead the Romans come up and they put him in chains. And they put two chains on him. Now, the crowd, of course, stops beating him. Commander's like, okay, we got to figure out what's going on. They bind Paul with two chains. And it's interesting that it mentions two chains to me. Again, a little bit of background historical research, and it shows that it was probably a shackle and a chain on each wrist. And then he was being held by probably two soldiers, one on either side. Again, this guy's being beaten by a mob, so their approach is to chain the guy that's being beaten up. I find that bewildering. But at any rate, this was, of course, the pattern that had been repeated over and over again in Jerusalem and other areas. But they bind Paul with two chains, and the soldiers attempt to discern the reason for the mob. We talked about this a little bit last week, but it's interesting to see here, too, that the soldiers couldn't figure out, the commander couldn't figure out why they were beating Paul. Because as with all mobs, there's only a few instigators, and the rest of them just go along with it and have no idea really what's going on. As most movements are, honestly. So they don't know what's going on. And so they then, of course, take Paul into the barracks, or are about to, because the violence of the mob was such that Paul had to be carried to ensure his safety. Now, again, it's hard to imagine that because I don't think any of us have ever been in this direct situation, but you have Roman centurions and 200 soldiers, and the mob is big enough that the Roman soldiers have to carry him away, and violent enough that they have to carry him away. They stopped initially beating him, but they didn't really want to let him go. So you can imagine this is a very tumultuous particular time and an event. So let's go back here. Verse 36. It says, "For the multitude of people kept following them, shouting, 'Away with him!'" Now, we read that in English, and we don't really think too much about it. Like, just get him out of our presence. However, this particular statement, it's not simply a desire to have Paul removed from their sight, but severely punished and eventually put to death. If we go over to Luke chapter 23, we'll see this phrase repeated, used earlier by the same group, about 60 years earlier or so. Luke chapter 23, verse 18. This is, of course, Jesus, when he's with Pilate, says, "But they, the Jews, cried out all together, saying, "Away with this man, and release for us Barabbas." Let's go over to John chapter 19. Chapter 19, verse 15. So they cried out, "Away with him! Away with him! Crucify him!" Pilate said to them, "Shall I crucify your king?" The chief priests answered, "We have no king but Caesar." So this cry of "away with him," it wasn't simply just to get him out of their sight. They wanted him killed. They wanted him executed. They wanted him no longer to be a voice of opposition, as you will, or if you will. Let's go over to Acts chapter 22. We see this again, this "away with him" phrase being used again. Verse 22, now this is at a transition point in Paul's defense. They, the Jews, listened to him up to this statement, and then they raised their voices and said, "Away with such a fellow from the earth, for he should not be allowed to live." I'll just tell you, when we start trying to police people's words, we're all in trouble. So, just keep that in mind. All right. So, in this great tumult, this great confusion, Paul has the state of mind here in verse 37 to stop and to take the opportunity to speak to the violent mob. Verse 37 is Paul. Actually, for the sake of context, let's go ahead and read just 37 through 40. It says, as Paul was about to be brought into the barracks, he said to the commander, "May I say something to you?" And he said, "Do you know Greek? Then you were not the Egyptian who some time ago stirred up a revolt and led the 4,000 men of the assassins out into the wilderness?" But Paul said, "I am a Jew of Tarsus in Cilicia, a citizen of no insignificant city. I beg you, allow me to speak to the people." When he had given him permission, Paul, standing on the stairs, mentioned to the people with his hand, and when there's a great hush, he spoke to them in the Hebrew dialect, saying, and then he goes on. So Paul has the state of mind to understand he has an audience at this point. It's a strange way to gather an audience, but he has an opportunity. He sees it, and he seizes upon it. Paul speaks to Claudius, who is surprised that Paul speaks Greek. So Claudius mentions this Egyptian and the revolt that this Egyptian had brought up. And this illustrates the tempestuous relationship between the Jews and their Roman captors. Because remember, this is not the first time that this kind of uproar had happened. It had happened many, many times. There's always this constant friction. And if you look in Josephus, in his writings, he tells of an Egyptian false prophet who led a revolt a few years earlier. He led 4,000 men out to the Mount of Olives, and the Roman soldiers responded, and they killed hundreds of these assassins. But the leader had escaped, so they didn't know who he was. Now, the assassins here, it's a loanword from Latin, sicari, meaning the dagger men. These 4,000 men had apparently been very dangerous people. So, now, again, you have this event, and you put yourself in Claudius's shoes. You have this event that I'm sure was a big deal. You have 4,000 people called assassins who were leading a revolt. The revolt didn't go as well as they'd hoped, and they essentially retreat to the Mount of Olives, and the Romans kill hundreds of them, but they don't find the mastermind. Only a couple years in the past. So then you see this instance rising up here where there's a great number of people rising up to punish this man, Paul, and you're thinking in the back of your head, I see a promotion in this. I wonder if this is the guy. Because that's what he was thinking. Otherwise, why would he have brought it up? If he wasn't thinking that this was the guy that was responsible for the last revolt, then why bring it up? So The Roman centurion, Claudius, or excuse me, the commander, I think saw this as an opportunity until he figured out that Paul was not, in fact, the Egyptian.
All the more reason for them to put him in chains when they took him out of the crowd.
Yep. That's exactly where I was going with this, is that I think that the reason that they did it, that they put him in chains initially, was because they thought he was more, thought he was somebody else. All right. So, Paul then identifies himself as a Jew from Tarsus and a citizen of Rome. This whole situation, again, illustrates just how confused this mob was. They couldn't figure out, they couldn't ascertain from the mob why Paul was being beaten. So they arrived at their own conclusion. So he identifies himself as a Jew from Tarsus and a citizen of Rome. With permission, Paul then begins to speak to the mob in Hebrew, which is really just Jewish Aramaic. And so then Paul begins to make his defense. So, again, putting yourself in this situation, how would you address hundreds, if not thousands, of people who wanted to kill you? Very carefully. So, let's read here Acts chapter 21. We'll go ahead and read, 22. We'll go ahead and read here up through verse 21, just to get the whole context here, and then we'll come back and chat some of about this. So, Acts chapter 22, beginning in verse 1. In Hebrew, he says, "Brethren and fathers, hear my defense, which I now offer to you." And when they had heard that he was addressing them in the Hebrew dialect, they became even more quiet. And he said, "I am a Jew, born in Tarsus of Cilicia, but brought up in this city, educated under Gamaliel, strictly according to the law of our fathers, being zealous for God, just as you all are today. I persecuted this way to the death, binding and putting both men and women into prisons, as also the high priest and all the council of the elders can testify. From them I also received letters to the brethren and started off for Damascus in order to bring even those who were there to Jerusalem as prisoners to be punished. But it happened that as I was on my way, approaching Damascus about noontime, a very bright light suddenly flashed from heaven all around me, and I fell to the ground and heard a voice saying to me, 'Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me?' And I answered, 'Who are you, Lord?' And he said to me, 'I am Jesus the Nazarene, whom you are persecuting.' And those who were with me saw the light, to be sure, but did not understand the voice of the one who was speaking to me. And I said, 'What shall I do, Lord?' And the Lord said to me, 'Get up and go on into Damascus, and there you will be told of all that has been appointed for you to do.' But since I could not see because of the brightness of that light, I was led by the hand by those who were with me and came into Damascus. A certain Ananias, a man who was devout by the standard of the law and well spoken of by all the Jews who lived there, came to me and standing near said to me, 'Brother Saul, receive your sight.' And at that very time I looked up at him. And he said, 'The God of our fathers has appointed you to know his will and to see the righteous one and to hear an utterance from his mouth. For you will be a witness for him to all men of what you have seen and heard. Now why do you delay? Get up and be immersed and wash away your sins, calling on his name. It happened when I returned to Jerusalem and was praying in the temple that I fell into a trance. And I saw him saying to me, "Make haste and get out of Jerusalem quickly, because they will not accept your testimony about me." And I said, "Lord, they themselves understand that in one synagogue after another, I used to imprison and beat those who believed in you. And when the blood of your witness Stephen was being shed, I also was standing by approving and watching out for the coats of those who were slaying him." And he said to me, "Go, for I will send you far away to the Gentiles." So this is essentially what all Paul is able to say. We know that after this, they're basically done listening. But let's back up and talk about a few things here. So, Paul makes his defense to the Jerusalem mob. And I'm just going to tell you, a lot of this section we've already covered when we talked about the early life of Paul and his conversion. So we're not going to talk a lot of detail here. It's already been covered. I don't want to repeat it. But he begins his address in the Hebrew dialect to the assembled Jews And notice what he says there in verse 22. He says, brethren and fathers. This opening, given in Hebrew, was meant to convey sincere respect for them with the intent to calm and quiet the crowd. So, this opening is not, this is not the first time we've heard this opening to a defense of the gospel. Anybody else have an idea where this may have come from? Where somebody else used this very same phrase? And it went just about as well for him. Go ahead and yell it out. Stephen. Let's go back to Acts chapter 7. Acts chapter 7. This is, of course, Stephen beginning his defense. Verse 2, and he, this is Stephen, said, hear me, brethren and fathers, the God of glory, etc., etc. So this particular opening was used to convey respect for the office, respect for them, respect for what they had all been taught, and give Paul an opportunity to speak here. If you look at the Greek word here, when he says defense, anybody guess what word that is in Greek? Apologia, apologetics. He's making a defense for what he believes in. He was going to directly answer the charges brought against him, but do it in such a way that he would be able to preach the gospel to them in the same opportunity or in the same way. The two things that he was really going to work on is establishing the fact that Jesus is Lord. But he had to start with dealing with some of the false reports that he was teaching people everywhere against the Jews and the law. And of course, he also wanted to discuss his reason for associating with the Gentiles. In the first five verses there, he reviews his early life. If you remember, he was born in Tarsus. He had religious training in Jerusalem. Tarsus was the capital and no insignificant city. It was known for its school of literature and philosophy. And as we discussed a long time ago, it was said to exceed even those of Athens and Alexandria. So Tarsus was a very important city. He was born of Jewish ancestry. And then he mentions that he was educated under Gamaliel, a Pharisee and respected teacher of the law. So, for lack of a better way of putting it, he was name-dropping. I didn't just come here and, you know, wander around the marketplace and get taught Judaism. I was instructed and discipled by, essentially, Gamaliel, a very respected and well-known teacher. If you go back to Acts chapter 5, we won't for the sake of time, but in the early days of the church, remember Gamaliel was the one that was like, God's going to work this out. So just let's back off and let God work this out. It's Acts chapter 5, verses 34 through 40. So Gamaliel was a very important and well-respected teacher of the law. And Paul mentions, hey, I was taught by Gamaliel. And then, of course, he goes on and he discusses his persecution of the church. Paul reminds them of his zeal in persecuting the early church. And this was something that the elders, the council, the Sanhedrin, that they knew very well because they were involved in it. He's the one, remember, went up to them and was like, hey, I want to snuff this insurrection out. I want to put an end to this, what he considered false teaching. And of course, the council was like, yeah, go for it. You know, here's the card, go for it. You know? So, he then relates the circumstances of his conversion. Again, I'm not going to talk a lot of detail there, but these, of course, are recorded, some of the things that he had mentioned earlier. Luke records it in Acts chapter 9, and again, Paul will again recount this particular issue or the situation of his conversion in Acts chapter 26. So, let's move on from there down to verse 17, unless there's any questions or comments about the conversion aspect that you don't feel like we've covered. Okay, so verse 17. Paul, he starts discussing with them. Now, he says, it happened when I returned to Jerusalem and was praying in the temple that I fell into a trance. So Paul relates his conversion, says, I go back to the temple in Jerusalem, and then he has this vision. At this point, Paul begins to shift to his reason for his involvement with the Gentiles. In the vision, the Lord told him to flee Jerusalem. Verse 18, "And I saw him saying to me, 'Make haste and get out of Jerusalem quickly, because they will not accept your testimony about me.'" So who was it that Paul was preaching when he was traveling around? Right? He's preaching Christ, Christ crucified. 1 Corinthians 1. So Paul introduces the first part of the vision with an intention of setting up the second. You notice that he doesn't just say, get out of Jerusalem because they're not going to believe what you said about me and go to the Gentiles. He introduces the vision and says, this is what the Lord told me, that you guys, that the Jews, aren't going to believe what you're going to say about me. And I think there's some interesting components here. But the Lord specifically states that they will not accept your testimony about me. So Paul is making the connection here that while he's in the temple, the Lord God appeared to him and said, they're not going to believe what you say about me. Well, who was it that Jesus was preaching? Jesus. Jehovah God and Jesus Christ are the same. And I think that's part of a little bit of a side point, but I find it interesting. So, Paul, I think he sincerely hoped that the Jews would listen to what he was told by the Lord and eases them into the portion of the vision pertaining to the Gentiles. I think he honestly believed that they would listen. Because remember, Paul was bound in spirit to go to Jerusalem and was under the impression that he would probably find some opportunity to preach to the Jews. Because we know that Paul ends up going to Rome. Does he know that by this time? No. He just knows that Jerusalem, there's going to be some opportunity. It's going to result in chains, but he's going to take the opportunity. So think about the day of Pentecost. On the day of Pentecost, when the gospel was first preached, how many millions of people heard it? How many hundreds? How many thousands? Let's just put it down to this, to the lowest number that we can. How many thousands heard the message? Exactly the number that were converted? No. A very small portion of those who had heard and seen what happened on Acts chapter 2 on the day of Pentecost were actually converted. I think Paul here is looking at this like another opportunity. Hey, there's thousands of people in the city. I'm going to give these people the opportunity to hear the gospel. So he takes it. Because it wasn't until after Paul's address to the council that he is told by the Lord that he would go to Rome. Acts chapter 23. So let's go ahead and go over there. Acts 23, this is after Paul's defense, after he's arrested, they have a meeting set up with the council of elders. And in verse 11, and we'll cover this when we get there, a little bit more detail. But it says, on the night immediately following, the Lord stood at his side and said, take courage. Stop there for just a second. Why would you tell somebody to take courage? Because they needed it. Because maybe they were a little like, I'm not really sure what's going on here. The Lord says, take courage, for as you have solemnly witnessed my cause at Jerusalem, so you must witness at Rome also. Paul's intent was to be a witness for Christ in Jerusalem. That's why he was there. This is why he took the opportunity. He saw it, and he knew that if he was dragged away to prison, he would probably not have the opportunity to speak again. So he took the opportunity. And of course, in this vision, I think it's also interesting, the Lord there in... I jumped ahead a little bit, sorry. So Paul, as he introduces this, he tells them, verse 19, he says, "And I said, Lord, they themselves understand that in one synagogue after another, I used to imprison and to beat those who believed in you." You notice Paul's like answering their objections before they even make them. Paul's like, wait a minute, I should be able to speak to the Jews because they understand who I was. They understand my zeal for the law. They understand my zeal for you. So I should be able to speak to the Jews and have them listen. And he goes on and he talks about how he was there, and they knew it, at the stoning of Stephen. Paul's perspective was that if anybody's going to listen, it's going to be the Jews. But he goes on and he says, and he said to me, verse 21, go, for I will send you far away to the Gentiles. It's at this point that they don't want to hear anymore. Like, I'm done. We're all done. That's it. It's fine having your own vision about anything that has to do with us, but if it's going out to the Gentiles, we're done. We don't want to hear it anymore. Verse 22, they listened to him up to this statement, and then they raised their voices and said, away with such a fellow from the earth, for he should not be allowed to live. They did not want to hear what Paul had to say. In that verse 21, if you look in the like a Discovery Bible, or if you know Greek well enough, which I do not, but in the vision, the I, where the Lord says, I will send you, it is the emphasized word in the Greek sentence structure. And he told them to go to the Gentiles. I find that, again, interesting, because it wasn't just about the Gentiles. It was the Lord God saying, I will send you far away to the Gentiles. Again, it's just this, totally lost the word. It's where this the God's plan is really being described as coming together. God's plan had always been for the Gentiles. We see that throughout the Old Testament scriptures. It was something that Paul worked very hard to communicate to the first century church. Super Dave?
You got to remember, too, that at that point in time, the Jews were still living under the law. And they did the same thing with Jesus. You know, when Jesus, they were accusing him of making himself out to be equal to God, mm-hmm. which we know he is. Mm-hmm. But they're referring the same thing to Paul, saying that he has a direct revelation, you know, with mm-hmm. God, and he's directly communicating with God, so it's making them look bad. Mm-hmm. You know, and in doing so, they're not going to have it. They're going to hold their position, if you will. Yeah.
And I think, you know, we had seen before, and of course we have other instances of it, but the father of John the Baptist, of course, had seen the Lord. And I don't know that they were necessarily taking it that he was making himself out to be God, but certainly that I can see where they were a bit jealous of it, if you will, that they had, that Paul had was claiming to have heard from the Lord of glory. All right, so we'll just go ahead and stop there. Any questions or comments before we wrap up? All right, thank you for your attention.